Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Songs of Our Lives. I am Brad Rose. I am an artist. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Songs of Our Lives. I'm Brad Rose. I'm an artist, a composer, a writer, the founder of Foxy Digitalis, and someone who thinks about music and sound far more than is healthy. Each week, I invite on a guest to talk about the songs and the music that has meant a lot to them and left its mark. Previous guests include Sarah DeVacci, Wendy Eisenberg, Maurice, Claire Rousset, Sarah Hennies, Cadence Weapon, Gelato Negro. Ah! I try to do this off the top of my head and I forget. Anyway, this week's guest, which is much more important to this episode, is Amelia Courthouse, a.k.a. Leah Toth. I was so excited to have Leah on. I'd actually been thinking about this one for a while, and then when the new Amelia Courthouse album, Broken Things, got announced by Spinster, awesome label, it's like, oh, perfect opportunity. So it took a little longer than expected, but there's so much about this album resonates with me, and Leah and I talk about it, so I'm not going to get into it too much, but it's like such an emotional listen, especially the sidelong version of Nearer My God to Thee. It's one of my favorite pieces of music of 2024, and it's like one of those things, you know, like when you hear something or you see something or even smell something, like you have this reaction, and it's like you feel it in the deepest parts of your bones because it's just this thing that is just ingrained in your memory and your body. That's kind of how that piece of music did that for me. The whole album's fucking great, and if you haven't heard it, what are you even doing? You should go out and do that as soon as you listen to this. Anyway, so yeah, we recorded this a little while ago. It was way too much fun, and I know you're gonna have a whole lot of fun listening to it. So see you on the other side. My guest today is a musician, a songwriter, a writer, I don't know, an educator, and a grief Sherpa. It's Leah Toth, aka Amelia Courthouse. Woo! Hello? Had to get that in there. Had to get the grief. That's, gosh, you need to put that on your resume. Like,
I don't know how popular that would be. I mean, I'm totally willing and... but and yet, yeah, I don't know if people want that or want to be in a position where they would need a grief Sherpa.
Yeah. Oh, I think we all could at some points in our lives. But okay, so you have a new record, Broken Things. It's out now on Spinster. It's your first album in 5 years.
Yeah, it's been 5 years. Spinster put out a cassette called Ruby Glass in 2019. So yes, but it's been a while.
So have you been working on this for 5 years, or was there just like after the last one, life happened, took a break, I don't know, or is it just...
Yeah, I think I'm trying to remember exactly when I started working on it. It was definitely after the first year of the pandemic, so maybe 2021 I started working on it. I've been in a tenure track position at a college in Wisconsin, and one of the things about working toward tenure is it's a lot of work. So you're teaching, you're publishing, you're doing service, and it takes up a lot of time and effort. Right. So during the pandemic, I finally had some time to think about things. I really think it was like maybe spring of 2021, and it did take most of that time for sure. I think that the track that you mentioned on Twitter, the hymn, the sidelong jam, on side B. It took about 2 years between the recording
and
the recording of it all. So yeah, I work really slowly.
Yeah.
On top of being, you know, having a job and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. Well, I want to talk. So like one of the things I really love the record, first of all.
Yeah.
But the references, and obviously like Near My God to Thee, like Protestant church music, that like hit me on a core level. So I'm guessing, so did you grow up in the church, as they say? As
yeah. No, I did. I grew up, my mom is a Southern Baptist, so that is the faith tradition into which I was brought. Grew up in the church, and started playing in the church when I was 13, 14 years old.
Oh, wow.
The pianist at my church, we were the first Baptist church of the small town in Alabama that I'm from. And the church pianist was injured in a car accident, and the church asked me to fill in for her.
Oh, wow.
And I did that. And then when she came back, the deacons decided to pay for organ lessons for me. I was the nerdiest high schooler of all time. I still vividly remember a friend of mine after class one day, Jody, he was like, "Hey, let's go hang out. You know, Brad's got some friends over. Let's go hang out." And I said, "Oh, I can't. I've got to go to church for my organ lesson." And he said, "That is the lamest shit imaginable. You're like 16 years old and you're going to have your organ lesson."
Hey,
but yeah, I grew up in the church and playing in the church, which is a thing I also did in college. I played at a church throughout college and made some good money for a college student playing weddings and funerals and things like
yeah.
that. So yeah, that's the background.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I so my grandfather was a preacher, not like non-denominational, but very like Baptist vibes.
Sure.
My grandmother, she was the organ, like she played the organ.
Oh, cool. Cool.
This song, like Near My God to Thee, oh my God. Like I had to stop, like when I started listening to it, and especially when the organ comes in, I had to stop like for a minute and kind of compose myself. Cause my grandmother passed away. Gosh, it's like almost 2 years ago now. And I live in her house, like we bought her house from her, but like,
oh wow, yeah,
5 years before she died, she moved with my parents, and then yeah, so like there is, I have, and she was like my second mom, I mean, I yeah, so that song, whew, yeah,
it's heavy. Oh, I think I get it. It's totally heavy. And I'm sorry about your grandmother. I understand. I was very, very close to mine, and it's so hard to lose them.
Yeah.
And you're like in her space, which is, that's got to be meaningful. And it feels like there's a presence there.
Yeah. We talk about that all the time. Cause it's, so they had a church when I was growing up. It was like about 30 miles outside of Tulsa. And in 1991, it got destroyed by a tornado. Because it's the most Oklahoma story there is. And actually, this tapestry behind me is like one of the things that survived. This is like family heirloom.
I love it. I've been admiring it. It's
yeah,
really cool.
It's like the Lion King or whatever. I don't know. it was apparently given to them as a gift in the 60s. So, but anyway, it was like church and they had an apartment in the church. It got destroyed. They took the insurance money and bought this house. And my grandfather was also a very accomplished carpenter. So he gutted the house, rebuilt it. So it's like their presence is just in the bones of this house.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's really cool.
Yeah, but so when that song, like I was listening to it on the stereo and I had to turn it off, and my wife and my kid were both like, "Why'd you turn that off? That was really pretty." I was like, "I just need a minute." And then, but it just, yeah, I don't know. It was really cool. So I am curious, like, what is, why, like, of all the, like, really great sort of hymns that you could have done. Why that one?
There has to be an almost arbitrary reason for that particular choice. I was thinking, like, my favorite songs in church were always sort of the ones played at the end of the service where, you know, people are coming forward and the pastor's standing up front and, you know, there's soft, pretty music. Like, I live for that. I love that part of the service. I always have. And this is one of those songs, I think, that would be played at that moment. And I was thinking about Brian Blade, the jazz musician whose album Body and Shadow has a gorgeous version of Have Thine Own Way, Lord. And it's really short. There's two versions. There's a solo version and then there's a band version. And they're both like a minute long. I mean, really, really short. And James, my husband, had bought me this really crappy chord organ at a yard sale in our neighborhood while I was out of town. And when I came home, you know, he had set it up in the living room. Of course, I'm playing it and it's reminding me of being in church.
Right.
So if, I think that was the first hymn that I thought of, like, printing out the sheet music for. So I don't really know why it was that one, other than the fact that it was in this realm of other hymns that are favorites of mine. And so the whole impetus behind that long track was just wanting it to last forever.
Yeah.
Kind of thinking about it as a way to retreat back to something from your childhood that's comforting and beautiful that can maybe, I don't know, we were joking about being a grief Sherpa, but kind of moving you through a period in your life that you didn't feel scared and you didn't feel sad or worried about things, just trying to like find that feeling again. And I think there's also something you read about trauma response and the purpose of repetition and trauma and how like people will keep telling the same story over and over again or thinking through the same question over and over again. Or in this case, just listening to the same song or playing it over and over again in search of some kind of clarity or a place of peace that is pretty difficult to find. And so I think that's what I was going for with that piece by making it so long and then having kind of these imperfect versions of the hymn played on this really awful chord organ, which I deeply love, by the way. I don't mean to shit the chord organ. And then like the big church organ at the end, which I know like in experimental music, that's a little bit conventional to kind of have the release at the end of a song. You know, there's this tension up and then there's like, but it's so satisfying to hear the big church version at the end. So yeah, that's kind of, I didn't really know how to end it, but I think like another version of the song had like a thumb piano. And I listened to it for a while and then I was away from it for a week or two and I came back to it and I thought, no, this is all wrong. It's got to end the big church.
Right.
Organ.
The big send off. Oh man, it's so good. Oh man. Also was going to ask about I'm a big field recordings nerd, but the field recordings that, like, don't get me wrong, love like nature recording stuff. I mean, I do a lot of work with like that in different ways, but the ones like the and this is something I've been thinking about a lot, like the room tone and like the sound of a space is, I'm kind of obsessed with that at the moment. I'm curious how, like, what draws you to like wanting to record, like make or field recording? Cause the dog snores too, by the way. Amazing. But like, is there something that draws you to particular sounds or is it just like, I don't know. Like for me, like I'm always recording shit. It drives everybody I know crazy.
Yeah.
Like anytime we're doing something, I'll be like, oh, okay, you guys go ahead. I heard something over here. I'm going to, but I'm curious, like what maybe like draws you to those things or what, like what you look for maybe.
I was thinking about the dog recording. I was sitting at my table, the same one I'm sitting at now. And my dog, Virgil, who's passed on about 2 years ago, was sitting underneath my chair by my feet. And he was so sweetly snoring and loudly snoring. And I think like that sound in particular, the sound of a snoring dog is the sound of a safe and comfortable animal that feels very loved and very secure and very happy, happy enough that they can show their belly while they're sleeping, which I guess animals really don't do in the wild because obvious reasons, it sometimes can attack them. So I think like that sound in particular is was the sound of something I deeply loved. And I don't know when it occurred to me to add it to Vihangi, but I do collect sounds kind of like you were saying, like you said, you're obsessed with room tone right now. So the natural kind of ambience that a room has and trying to record that. But I just notice things. I really think it's about being tuned in. And of course, there are certain sounds that I really don't like and wouldn't want to put on a recording. But other things like there's some wind chimes in one of the songs. And it doesn't sound at all like wind chimes in the song. So I love the way when you treat something, when you run it through.
Yes.
Like, effects in some way, it like totally transforms the sound. But kind of like you were just saying, I hear a thing and I think, well, that should be recorded. And I'm almost always thinking of it in a textural way. So how could this be built on with other textural sounds to kind of create something interesting when you're listening to it?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm doing this fellowship thing right now that's through the University of Tulsa, but it's, our theme is space. And originally I wasn't interested in it because I thought they were talking about outer space. And I was like, you know, outer space is cool, but like my work has nothing to do with outer space. But then I was learning more about it and it was like, well, you know, it can also mean like how we organize space or just like spaces on Earth. And I was like, oh, okay, this is my kind. And so I've been talking a lot, like we've been doing it for 3 weeks now. I've been talking a lot about how, like, I don't know, because I've had conversations with people, like, I don't know how, like, for me, the sound of a space has this huge impact on how I experience or feel in a space. And a lot of times when I talk about that, people just look at me like, huh? And so I think I'm always really, like, when I find somebody or, you know, that you hear something where it's like, oh, somebody, this is the sound of the room where this happened, I get excited because I think, I don't know, I think sound is, it's, yeah, I don't know, it's sound, I don't know, it's
it's not, I mean, I guess it's weird, but it's not that weird. There are just people who are tuned in to things like this. I was listening to a David Lynch interview, or goodness, maybe it was a book I was reading, but he's talking about the sound design in Eraserhead, and he commented that, and something this has stuck with me over time, that every room is a hair live. I can't say it in a Lynchian voice, but that was the phrase, a hair live, like H-I-H-A-I-R, a hair live. And so he's talking about the need to control the sound in a room. I really like the idea that every room is a hair live, like it has its own sound that you might not even notice at times unless you're tuned into it or experimenting with it. Like I have in one of my classes, my students do their own Alvin Lucier recording.
That's awesome.
But we do it on digital. So it also sort of shows them the difference between analog and digital recording. But they're like, what the hell are we doing right now? Like, you know, like, Dr. Toth, what is this? And then they do it and they're proud of it. It always like kind of forces them into new ways of listening, which is kind of the point.
Right. Yeah, that's always, and I've had, like, I really want to build some kind of, I don't know where I'm going to do this or when I'm going to do this, but like, you have like having this like really beautiful, inviting looking room and you go in it and then it's just like, you hear like leaf blowers and like harsh, like just messing with people, because, you know, kind of messing with people's perception of it, but just getting them to think like, oh, it's not just what it looks like that is making something feel good or feel bad. And I don't know. I got to find someone to like give me some money to do that. But
that's I'm really into that idea. Like the sort of incongruence between the way a room looks and the way it sounds.
Yeah. It was like I had a friend who was telling me that her sister made mint ice cream for their family, but put purple food coloring in it. And it, everybody, like, they couldn't get their head around it. It's like, yeah, that would fuck my head. I couldn't.
Yeah. Yeah. So. No, it's the same kind of weird, like messing with expectations.
Yeah. It's fun. It's fun to mess with people. I mean, it is, but that's not the point. Okay. Well, I could talk about this stuff forever, and I don't know how many people want to hear me talk about this. So I'm going to switch gears. The whole reason we're here is to talk about songs. I do have to say, so this is like the 50-something episode of this I've recorded. Like one of the games I sort of play is people send me their song list and I try to guess what goes to what. And I've gotten pretty good at it.
Yeah.
With yours, I have virtually no fucking clue. I'm like, yeah, it's like this could be this or this or this. So I'm really excited to see where the hell this goes.
Yeah, I know, it's fun. I love the concept of like kind of getting to know people better through their thoughts about music.
Exactly. It's like, I mean, I care about the songs, but I only half care about the songs. I mostly care like why they're the songs for this.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
So with that, as ever, to start, what is the first song that you remember?
Oh, this was so hard for me, and I had to cheat. I cheated on this one. And
that's fair.
It's sort of it's of a piece for me because so much of my scholarship deals with technologies and memory and sound. Mm. And so my answer to this is that I couldn't remember. And so what I went with was the earliest recording of me singing a song. And it was Pearl Bailey's song, The Best of Friends. And it's from The Fox and the Hound. And apparently when I was 5, I had this book, The Fox and the Hound, and my mom used to read it to me. And I loved it so much that I memorized it. so that when she would turn the pages, you know, I would know what was coming next. And I would recite the book along with her as she was reading. But there is a recording of me, which she finds adorable and I find awful, of little Leah at 5 years old singing The Best of Friends from The Fox and the Hound. And my goodness, it is excruciating. But so I'm relying on it, you know, Frederick Kittler about how memories are not really memories. They're just the pictures from our vacations or recordings and that sort of thing. So my altered memory, that is the very first song that I can remember. And probably to your point earlier, it was a hymn of some kind, really.
Sure.
But this is a cool answer.
Yeah, no, I mean, everybody, I think I've seen The Fox and I think I've seen the Disney movie, like one, I can't remember, but this keeps coming up and everybody, at least people around my age, I don't know, maybe younger, like I'm 45. So, like we all have our Disney song, like thing, like, so, and your story about having a recording of it. I have a recording somewhere of my sister and I singing Somewhere Out There from An American Tale.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I remember that one too.
And it's really funny how, I mean, amount of times that Disney songs, I mean, this, yeah, come up is, I mean, it makes sense, but it's still kind of funny. I don't remember The Fox and the Hound though at all.
You know, I have to say, I barely remembered it either.
You don't have it memorized anymore.
No, I had to go look up the plot, which is pathetic. Yeah, like that something was once so important to you that you memorized every word, and then your brain, all these years later, cannot remember at all what it was like. Is jarring, but yeah, I had to look it up. It's sad, kind of like An American Tale. It was sad.
Yeah, all those. Gosh, so like that era of Disney movie, God,
it's really sad.
Weak.
Yeah.
No wonder we're all fucked up. That's All right. Well, speaking of bleak, maybe, I don't know. What's a song that makes you cry?
Okay. So this one was easy. And the answer is Beth Nielsen Chapman's song, Sand and Water. I do not know any other performances by Beth Nielsen Chapman. When I was in graduate school for my master's degree, my roommate was in seminary. And so I thought, like, maybe this is a church song. Like, this has to be like some religious song. And I don't think that it was. I don't think that it is. Apparently, Beth Nielsen Chapman is a Grammy Award winning songwriter. And she wrote, do you remember the Faith Hill song, This Kiss?
Oh, yeah.
Late 90s. Who wrote that song?
Oh.
And yeah, I don't know either. I just had this song, you know, it's one that's been with me over the years because of my roommate, Katie. And it just makes me like irrepressibly sad. I think it's kind of a reminder of the fragility of life and and sort of and really like the loneliness of the grieving experience. There's this line in it that's like all alone. And then, you know, the next part of the line will tackle a part of grief that's mm-hmm. difficult. And grief is such a lonely and alienating experience, I think. And I don't like having that reminder. I don't like the song. I don't like to hear it. Mm-hmm. So it's been a long time since I've heard it because I don't want to be sad. Oh. I mean, I'm generally a pretty self-motivated and generally very happy person. And I can vibe with darkness. Like if a friend of mine is going sure. through it, I am here. I'm, you know, talk to me about it. I'm going to listen. But these songs and this song like this is just too much for me. I don't like to hear it. And I was thinking a follow-up is the Pedro de Lion song, Priests and Paramedics. Do you know that
one? Yeah, I can't listen to that.
Yeah, I can't listen to it either. It's just so bleak that... Yeah. There's not even a thing about it to have right. you.
Yeah, I'd never heard of this, and I got through it. I was like, Jesus Christ! Every line in this song is just like a dagger through the heart.
Right? No, like, it's too much. It's too much.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what other side of it? What will put you in a better mood?
So a song that can reliably put me in a better mood is. Larry Young's Khalid of Space.
Yeah. Whole.
And yeah, it's monumental. So that is from Lawrence of New York, which is I think 1973. Yeah. And it's an example of organ jazz. And Ferris Sanders plays on that record and James Blood Ulmer plays on that record too. And it's a whole host of characters.
Yeah.
But that song has got to be like 12 or 13 minutes long. And God, he just like, it just rips a hole in the ether. That solo, yeah. The Larry Young solo, like toward the end of the song. I think like organ jazz can be cheesy, right? It can be cheesy. And I think there are not a lot of songs or albums that do it really well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Jimmy Smith's album, Back at the Chicken Shack. That's like a decade earlier, I think. But that one is really good, too. But Khalid of Space just is incredible.
It's, yeah, like Lawrence of Newark is, yeah. It's like one of those albums that, I don't know, it's like you put it on and it's like, man, this is like what it feels like to be human. Because it, like, it's so like all-encompassing. And then, but even, like you said, it like just... Especially, yeah, God, that solo at the oh my God, it's like pure catharsis.
It is. And,
oh
yeah.
My God. It's, yeah, this is like, this has become one of my favorite records ever, I think.
Me
it's
too. Just, no, I love it. It's, there are very few records that do what that one does.
Mm-hmm.
I always put it on at the end of the semester after I've tangled my grades.
Like, yeah. It's so like this it's celebration, like, cause it's like, yeah. Yeah, and I think it's a really good point about like organ jazz is because I'm like when I was getting into jazz when I like late teens or something, and I listened to a lot of Jimmy Smith, and a lot of it like it was like it's okay,
yeah.
It didn't quite, yeah. But when yeah, like there are moments like the name just escaped me, the one you just said.
Yeah. Like, yeah, back to the Chicken Shack.
Back to the Chicken Shack. I was like, yeah, I was like, not live in the Chicken Shack. We're like, anyway. like it connects or something. But I can't think of a lot of organ jazz records that I love. Like, and there's certainly not anything I love like Lawrence of Newark, but like.
Yeah. That's an outlier even for Larry Young. You know, like.
Right.
You hear that when you get really psyched that you're thinking there's these others out there like it. And then you're just going to be disappointed because it's like transcendent, you know? It's
the exact experience I had is I was like, oh my God, this guy. And then went and listened to other stuff. It's like, well, it's fine.
Yeah.
But yeah. And I love all the weird horn, like all the electric horns and stuff on it. It's just weird. In a great way. Yeah. So good.
So okay. Good.
Okay, well, I think you can make a case that Khalid of Space is objectively the greatest song ever, but...
I think so, too. No, I think so, too. It's up there.
There's actually, like, a handful of songs on your list that I think you could make a case for, but what is the song you're going to make a case for as the objectively greatest song of all time?
Okay, yeah, and I think the way that you kind of framed this, which was really helpful, was like, if an alien shows up and you want to show them the height of sonic achievement, like what would it be? So, God, there are a lot of great ways to answer this question. And it's hard to answer because like you, I like so many genres and there are a lot of perfect songs out there. And I was thinking that the alien framing was helpful because I was thinking about the contents of the Golden Record, which NASA shot up into space in 1977. So it's still up there, and there's a chance that aliens will actually hear.
Yeah.
That aliens have ears. But so, like, Russia's got Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, and Germany's got Bach and Beethoven up there rotating, ready to be played at any moment, should an alien. And India has a nice raga. And then Australia has some Aboriginal music, and the U.S. has Chuck Berry, like doing Johnny B. Goode. And we also have Blind Willie Johnson and Louis Armstrong up there in space. So I feel like I should say that my answer to this question of what's objectively the best song of all time, it should be like a Thelonious Monk original, like Round Midnight, Panonica.
Yeah.
Like, well, you needn't. But I'm not going to say that. I'm going to be utterly predictable. And I'm going to say A Day in the Life from Sgt. Pepper's by the Beatles. That's what I'm going to say. So it's a totally obvious choice, but I want to make a case for it. It's the closer of the album. So it closes Sgt. Pepper's, but it's also just like, a closer. Like, I feel like if you wrote that song, you would just like, that would be it. Your work is finished. You don't really need to write anything else or record anything else. and for me, my work and, you know, my training as a PhD is in literary modernism. And so when I hear that Beatles song, it really makes me think of Virginia Woolf or T.S. Eliot or even John Dos Passos, because it's got like these sort of fragments of city life and newspaper snippets of terrible events, and then a crowd of people around trying to figure out what's happening. But then you've got the speaker, and I think John Lennon wrote the first verses of that, and Paul McCartney wrote the middle eight. And the speaker is visualizing the news story, and it's almost like he's there in it, like watching things happen, and he's sort of hallucinating it. And then Paul McCartney comes in and interjects this energy of daily life. You know, you've got, this dude just blew his mind out in his car, and all these people are vaguely wondering who he is. And Paul McCartney's like, well, got to go to work, lads. Like, you know, let's comb our hair and get going. And then like these disparate parts, like the Lennon kind of, you know, shoe gum, like daily observer vibe kind of dovetails with Paul McCartney in this kind of narcotic haze. You know, I'd love to turn you on, like to smoke and, you know, kind of fly away. And then you have Paul on bass just like framing everything. There's this sparse like opening on acoustic guitar, and then the piano kind of barges in, and it's all underscored by that wonderful bass part. And not to be outdone, that final chord at the end of the song is the greatest, most satisfying return to a tonic of any song ever recorded. And that is my case for A Day in the Life.
I mean, I got a lot of mixed feelings about the Beatles, but that's pretty convincing. It's pretty convincing. And this is like, I mean, objectively, like, this is a great song. Like, my mixed feelings about the Beatles have more to do with them and like their politics and their, you know, like Team Yoko forever. But like, but you know, that's neither here nor there. No, I mean, this is like, yeah, like, well, I hadn't listened to this in a while, and I put it on, and I was kind of just taken away by it, of like how, like all this, like how it's constructed is this sort of masterclass of songwriting.
Absolutely. And the arrangements are just incredible. Mm-hmm. It just, every part of it just feels so thoughtful and put together. And I wanted to add, like you mentioned, having mixed feelings about the Beatles. And one of the reasons why I hesitated when I put this song on my list is because it, in a way, I mean, if we think about rock and roll as stemming from Black song traditions, mm-hmm. and encountering a lot of resistance in the United States, it's very convenient that that music makes it overseas. And suddenly when it's repackaged and sent back to the US, it's very white and like flock-eared. And it's just like that part of things doesn't set too well with me, but right. I do still love the Beatles. I do think they're great. And so for them to be great, despite all of that,
sure.
Remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, and part of like my mixed feelings are like a lot of my earliest memories are sitting at home, like staying home sick from church when my mom went to church, and my dad and I would listen to Beatles and Bob Dylan records and Beach Boys.
And
now like my parents retired and downsized, so I have all my dad's like Bob Dylan and Beach Boys and Beatles records. And so but yeah, I mean, it's an absurdly, like, there's so many things like and the way you just ran through it is perfect, because it when you explain it, it sounds ridiculous. and I mean that in a good way, because it's like, how does this work so perfectly? And that's sort of the magic of it. I mean, it's not magic. There is a little magic there, but it's because they're really fucking good songwriters.
the arrangements, I think, are just incredible. It's so good. Yeah, I could. Yeah. I listened to it again just this morning, thinking about, you know, how it works. It's like, what do you say about this song? And then you listen to it and you look at the lyrics and you're like, well, there's a lot you can say about
it. Yeah.
It's more than you could fit into a podcast.
Right. Yeah. You could do like a whole podcast series about this song.
Yeah.
So if somebody does that, like, give us credit, because I'm not going to do that. Okay. Well, what's a song you used to love, but now, like, if you listen to it or if you think about it, like you heard it recently, maybe, you're just like, maybe there not so much.
There are a couple of contenders for this. I had to think about this. And I think that ultimately I am going to go with Josh Ritter's song, Kathleen, which is from an album that came out in 2003 called Hello Starling. And I think the time period is important. I think that is important. I really think that it hasn't aged well. And I hate saying that, because I've met Josh Ritter a couple of times and he's just the nicest guy. And in terms of songwriting, I think he's really broken the code. Like, I think he's a cut above others mining the same territory, that territory being relationships, essentially. Like, he's a guy that writes about love and writes about relationships, and that's his subject, and that's fine. And when I was in my 20s, I loved that song. And I love Golden Age of Radio, which I think came out a year or two before. But in retrospect, that song, Kathleen, it feels very much of a piece with aughts indie culture. And I've been thinking about this a lot, because I recently rewatched Vanilla Sky which came out around the same time, and 500 Days of Summer, which I've never seen before.
I've never seen Vanilla Sky, but I've seen 500 Days of Summer.
It's just so precious. Everything about it, like the manic pixie dream girl, or what I call the Jenny Lewisification of girls. Yes. It's kind of like how men maybe dream of women being, if they're perfect, you know, they're into Belle and Sebastian and they put ribbons in their hair and they say nothing but cute things all the time. And so I think that like Kathleen is a song that is this kind of part of that. And I think like when I was 23 years old, and maybe when a young woman is that age and you want to be beautiful and you want to be special and you want to be desired. And so there's that line, all the other girls here are stars. You're the Northern Lights. And you think that song's about me, like I'm Kathleen. Yeah. I want to be Kathleen. So it's like hopeful or aspirational. But now when I hear the song, I just kind of wince. I just like, even that line is like,
right.
It's a song of come on lines.
Right.
And yeah. I didn't do that. Like when I was in my young, it was like, like not to be overly dramatic about it, but it's like a guy hitting on you at the bar and it, it's not romantic. It's, but it was back then. Yeah. And I thought differently then. And now I just feel like it's just not, it didn't age well.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. I will say that I do really love the organ on it. Mm-hmm. What? That was my other, I can't even remember the last time I heard this, but when I was listening to it, it was, it felt a little bit just like, like you said, like you wince a little bit. Like it was like very cringy. But yeah, oh God, 500 Days of Summer. I haven't thought about that. This is that. Yeah.
Like I said, I saw it for the first time not that long ago because I'm just, you know, just looking for stuff to watch. Like my husband was out of town for like a whole month. So I'm just watching stuff and I was like, well, I've never seen this. And I watched it and I thought, holy hell, this isn't.
Can't imagine that aged well at all.
No, it really hasn't. It's rather shocking how poorly it's aged, truly. And I mentioned Vanilla Sky because the dialogue in that movie, the kind of flirty banter between Penelope Cruz and Tom Cruise is just excruciating. Oh, and I like Cameron Crowe. He's a great writer. Right. But man, that moment, there was something about it. It's just cheesy.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't seen Vanilla Sky. Now I'm like, I'm going to have to watch it and I'll just be prepared to just wince a lot. As I
let me know what you think if you see it. Okay. Like that movie, like a lot of it works really well, and I think as a music lover you'll really appreciate the music in the film.
Okay.
It's a bit conspicuous, like the dialogue, but it still kind of holds up, and there's a use of good vibrations toward the end that I still think is like really spot on.
Okay. All right, I'm gonna putting it on my on the list. I don't have a list, but we'll pretend.
Yeah.
Okay, what's the song that people, some group of people, I don't know who they are, people hate it, you don't care, you love it?
This song is certifiably hateable. I think if you Google it, you will see people talking shit about it.
Oh,
and
boy.
The song is MacArthur Park. Do you know that one?
I do.
So it's, I think it, Richard Harris first recorded it, I think. And it's got lyrics, but the version that I'm repping for is Maynard Ferguson's version.
I don't know if I knew the song. I don't know if I knew this version, but I'm not gonna lie, that melody kind of like, it just kind of sweeps you away. It's kind of great.
Oh, good. Okay. You love it. So I was thinking like, it's not a popular song. It's quite unpopular. I think people think of it as overly dramatic and sort of overdone. And I think Maynard Ferguson's version of it does not disabuse you of that because it's this like flashy higher register
right.
playing.
I could kind of imagine, like when I was listening to it, I was thinking, I can imagine this in, I don't know, like the intro of a 70s, like, sitcom or TV show.
Yes, exactly.
And then in my brain, I'm going, Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. It's a thing. It's really interesting to me, though, that this is, because it seems very like inoffensive. So I'm surprised there's people. It draws the ire of.
Yeah, no, it's pretty widely hated, which surprised me when I found that out too. I don't even remember how I did learn that it's so reviled, but it definitely is. And I think there are Reddit threads about it.
Oh wow. That's amazing. Now I'm morbidly curious. I want to go and find out why people hate it so much. Okay. Do you consider yourself a romantic?
I don't know. I don't know. If my husband is not in the room listening to me, he would say, no, she is not a romantic and she's really bad at flirting. Like, it was never a good flirt. So I think everybody likes to think of themselves as a romantic, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I would say that. Yeah, sure. But that's, I'm also funny, a modernist. So approaching the idea of romance with a healthy degree of skepticism and cynicism is probably more my vibe. But I do have a romantic song picked out. Yes.
So what is, yeah, what's the song?
So my song is Bobby Charles, I Must Be in a Good Place Now. And that is on his self-titled album, which is early 70s. Mm-hmm. I don't know, 71, 72. It's the anti-Kathleen. It's not a come on song and it's not overly sentimental. Like, you know, like Randy Newman's song Feels Like Home is gorgeous, but it is sentimental. Uh-huh. I love that one too. But this one is just kind of like, hey, yeah, I'm looking around and everything I see is beautiful. And I see you in that. And there's even this sort of thrill when he says his lover's name, you know, that like, mm-hmm, it's thrilling. I love it. Just speaking it, it makes such a lovely sound. I'm hoping we can ride this thing out, you know, this life thing together.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's pretty chill. There's like this kind of casual, easygoing sweetness to it. Yeah. And I think like the speaker's smitten, but he's not coming on too strong.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really good point. And I think, yeah, well, and his voice is just, like it just adds that other layer. It's like, okay, you can tell me anything, dude. Like I am in the palm of your hand.
He could slip into the Kathleen lyrics and would still be on.
Yeah,
board.
if there was a Bobby Charles version of Kathleen, I might feel differently. I don't know.
Maybe we all would. No shade at Josh Ritter, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like Josh Ritter has a great voice, but Bobby Charles is a whole different thing. Okay. Well, what's the song that changed your perspective on an artist, either for better or for worse?
Okay. My answer to this question, and it's going to be for better.
Okay.
It's going to be the Fleetwood Mac song, The Ledge from Tusk. I had really negative associations with Fleetwood Mac until about 10 or 12 years ago. I just thought of it like Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow and Bill Clinton, you know, I just, yep, see the Clintons like
100% the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yep. And so I just thought, well, this is what Fleetwood Mac is. And then not that long ago, maybe like 7 or 8 years ago, you have all these indie bands like Haim. And I can't think of others, but I'm thinking there's a constellation of artists back then. They're all like, oh, we love Fleetwood Mac. We love Fleetwood Mac. Mm-hmm. And it turns out they're really talking about three songs. I mean, like they love Dreams and they love maybe another few songs on Rumors. And so I thought Fleetwood Mac was not for me. And then I was listening to Tusk and my husband was trying to sell me on it, which he often does. James trying to sell me on Fleetwood Mac, and he's like, no, really, this is weird. You're going to love this. Like, Lindsay was trying to take things in different directions, and he was trying to be weird and unconventional. And so he plays me Tusk, and The Ledge is an example of that. And he was totally right. It's so strange.
Yeah. it's weird and fun. And like, I just reading about when I was prepping for this, I want to hear all the, like, all the other versions that they tried to make, where they, it was like, oh, we tried this, then we called it, and then a week later or whatever, Lindsay just tuned down his guitar a half step or a whole an octave, and which is still weird.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, this song is so bizarre. And, but it's, I don't know. Yeah. I think it, like, I totally agree. Like, when people say they love Fleetwood Mac, like, a lot of people like those, but it's, yeah, it's like the three big songs or whatever. And man, Fleetwood, there's so much more to them. Cause it's, it was, yeah, 10, 12 years ago when I really got into Fleetwood Mac. And now it's like, they're one of my favorite bands, but
yeah,
I do think, and I had this conversation on a way earlier episode of this, they're like, this one of these like choose your fighter bands, like everybody. And I think you learn something, like when it's like, who's your member of Fleetwood Mac? Like, who's your favorite?
Lindsay.
100%.
I'm a big Lindsay fan. He's such a weirdo. He's so strange. I think, you know, I've been listening to his, the anthology that he put out like a few years ago. I've been doing a painting project in my house and just like listening. And so I've been listening through that entire anthology. And, you know, the thing I notice about all of these songs is that they're really fucking good.
Right.
Like, they're great pop songs. I mean, yeah. Like, there, nobody really does pop music better than he does, especially the ear candy. And obviously he's a fantastic guitar player. Lyrically, he's lacking.
Yeah.
But he's just so strange. You'll hear, like, you know, Trouble, which is just a really good pop song. But then there's this song called Dancing Across the USA. Do you know that one?
I don't think so.
It was on Out of the Cradle, 1992, I think. It's like a country western Americana song. Brad, it's so weird. Oh, you have to hear it.
Okay, as soon as we got off this call, I'm gonna go listen to it.
I was texting Ben Chasney yesterday. He's playing a show here in a couple of days, so we're gonna see him. And he is a huge Lindsey Buckingham fan, which I love.
That's awesome. And
I said, hey, you got to cover. I was hoping you would cover Dancing Across the USA. And he hadn't heard it either. Had never heard it.
Oh, wow. So. Oh, I love, like, he's just such a weirdo. And I don't know. Like, and all his, I feel like, he, you know, he has all these different phases. They're all weird. Like, I don't think his solo stuff gets talked about, and I don't hear people ever really talk about his solo stuff, but man, there's so many just bangers.
One after another. And even, you know, one will come on and you'll think, well, this is kind of, I don't really want to hear this. And then you keep listening.
I know. And then it's like, oh.
Yeah. It becomes something. And I think he's just a great, and I like, in the age we're in now, of this ultra sort of commercial, not weird at all, pop music phenomenon. Like, he stands out, and I don't think anyone else is like him.
No.
And it worries me, because someone that singular, who's replacing him?
I know. And yeah, that we need. Yeah. Where is the next Lindsey Buckingham? That's the question we only ask. Oh, I love that. Okay. What are your favorite lyrics? Are you a big lyrics person?
I am a big lyrics person. That said, I can totally love a song with bad lyrics. So
awesome.
I know that sounds a little contradictory, but I do love getting into lyrics. And there's some artists whose production I'm not a huge fan of, but I'll listen to them anyway because their lyrics are great. Like, James McMurtry is a great example.
Mm.
In fact, one of the lyrics is his.
Yeah.
I chose two for this, and it was a tie, but I thought it was okay because both of the songs are about drinking.
Yeah.
And so since I mentioned James McMurtry, I'll just say the lyric from his song Hurricane Party that says, "I don't want another drink. I only want that last one again," is a lyric I think about shockingly often. And I think that's what makes it a great lyric. If there's a song that with a lyric in it that it encapsulates something that you felt before,
right?
Like, it feels like to, you know, you're on your second drink and it feels really good, and you only want to keep drinking because you want to keep that feeling.
Yep.
But of course, as any drinker knows, what happens is you lose that feeling when you have that next drink. So I love that line so much. I think about it a lot.
If somebody could invent a wave, you get to that point and you can just stay there.
Yeah.
They would be a billionaire. Yeah,
absolutely. It's remarkable. And that song just captures that so well. And the other one I was going to mention was from the Hanson Family song, So Much Wine, which came out in 2000 on their album In the Air. Weird, you know, totally basic title, totally forgettable, but the song is not forgettable. And the lyric goes, "Listen to me, butterfly. There's only so much wine you can drink in one life, but it will never be enough to save you from the bottom of your glass." Tragically true. Tragically true.
Yeah, that line hits real hard.
Well, and the rest of that song too, yeah.
Yeah, and there's something too about the lyric, like the "listen to me, butterfly." There's something about the address, like the butterfly. I don't know, because he could have chosen so many things there, but there's something like, I don't know, about that, like the specificity of it, which that's... This is something that I keep talking about on here when we talk about lyrics. It's like stuff where there's some very specific thing. Like, I was talking about, Nina Simone's been coming up a lot recently, which is not, but she, and I did it again. I keep forgetting the song, but it's like, it's a love song. It's like, it's like the sound of, I hear the sound of mandolins. And it's something about it being mandolins and not like violins or something that just, I don't know, but yeah, I love this song. It's such a good song, and that is such a good line.
It is such a good line, and I love the Hanson Family and Rennie Sparks. I'm such a super fan of for a while because they were on a roll in the 2000s, just record after record.
Yeah,
excellent music.
Yeah, what is the last song that you completely fell in love with?
Okay. I had to think about this one. I fall in love with a lot of music, but the most recent thing that I just got totally obsessed with is Bob Dylan's song "Brownsville Girl." And it's not a song that people talk about a lot. It's on, you know, it's the 80s period. It's on Knocked Out Loaded, which I think is 86.
Yeah,
86?
I think it's 85 or 86.
Yeah, 85 or 86. And I've been on this big Dylan kick because I kind of miss Dylan in a way. Like I wasn't one of those kids who got into him in high school or college. And so lately I've just been listening consecutively, you know, starting from the beginning and listening all the way through. And I've cheated a couple of times, like when James will find a Dylan CD for 50 cents and he'll bring it to me. And so of course I'm going to listen to it. And I was listening to Knocked Out Loaded. And, I was really taken with this album, and I was especially taken with this song. Do you know it, Brad?
Mm-hmm. So it's like co-written by Sam Shepard.
Yes.
I love Sam Shepard. And so that's why it's very familiar to me. Cause when I had a whole phase, I don't know, 10 years ago, I put out this tape by a friend of mine that was named Guadalupe in the Promised Land. And that was before I knew anything about Sam Shepard. I was like, what is this title? And he's like, oh my gosh, dude, I'm about to change your fucking life. And so I went, I had this whole thing I absolutely love this song.
Good. No, I'm glad you get it. Like, and it's one of his epic tracks.
Yes.
I think, but it's not like, it's not like Lily Rosemary, which is just interminable. And it's not even like Key West, you know, from the, what's the recent, Rough and Rowdy Ways. It's long and it's great, but Brownsville Girl is perfect. And I got so obsessed with it, I was leaving my friend's voice text about it. And I love that. Like, oh, here's Linda. Well, what's going on?
And then
it's me. Oh, it's just me talking about Bob Dylan. So, but I'm out there proselytizing because so many of my friends who are even big Grateful Dead fans are not, they're not listening to the 80s. They're not listening to 80s Bob Dylan.
Right.
I said Grateful Dead, but so like I was just kind of poking around the internet and I came across a really smart post. Do you know Recliner Notes?
Mm-hmm.
You know that? So there's a excellent blog entry on this song.
Oh, wow. I haven't heard that.
Yeah, no, it's great. And I learned a lot about the song. And I learned from reading this blog post that the Gregory Peck film mentioned in the song is The Gunfighter. It came out in 1950. So, you know, naturally, I'll go and watch the movie. And I'm not going to tell you, like, what it does. This is basically about this gunfighter, and his name is Jimmy Ringo, which is a perfect name. And he's got this legend built up around him, and people won't leave him alone. Like, he'll go into a bar, and men will try to fight him. And he's just like, I'm just trying to get my girl back. That's all. I want to get my girl back, and I want to get my kid back. And then I won't tell you what happens from there, but Bob Dylan gives it away in the plot. I mean, in the song.
Okay.
It's kind of like, wow. It's like he's beside you telling you the plot of the movie.
Oh, that's great.
But then, like, as the song continues, you get all of that great Dylan detail, like the busted down Ford and Ruby with her red hair tied back. Mm-hmm. But then you also get this shape-shifting and this instability in the narrative. Like, you know, the speaker is suddenly in the movie. Yeah, at first he's just feeling like, oh, I go watch these Gregory Peck movies, but then he's in it. Like, he's in the film, and then later he's not in it again. I know people read a lot into that, like regarding Dylan and his own legend and stuff like that.
Right.
I just like to sit back and listen to it and think about the story itself and its protean kind of qualities. And I really like Dylan's singing voice on that album, which is taken on this sort of fiery vigor that mm-hmm. was not always typical of him somehow.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I like it. I came around to, like, 80s Dylan. I don't know when I first started, like, because I, you know, initially it was like, oh no. But man, people are missing out. I mean, I think more people have come around to some of it, maybe.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I like all of Dylan's just, I find he's fascinating for so many reasons, and all his different periods are, there's like something in all of them that I find interesting, or, you know, like, yes, I have my favorites and I have the stuff I listen to the most, but I really like this album. I really like, and I think, you know, it may have been this song that got me to sort of reassess or reconsider 80s Dylan, and it's because of the Sam Shepard thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really, I'm putting it all together now. And so, like, I think, like, from this period, this is the album that I return to the most. Like, it's a really good album, and, like, it's, yeah, I know a lot of people, like my wife really doesn't like his voice in these records, but I just find it so, I think, like you said, there's like a fire to it where, I don't know. It's like, to me, I always think it's like, oh, maybe it's like he thinks he's been written off. He's like, oh, I'm don't even think about it.
No, I think, that's a good point. It's he's almost indignant, you know, like in those lines. I'm trying to remember the exact line from that song, but it's something like, I got no regrets. They can say what they want about me when I'm home. Like, fuck you guys.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm really curious too, like with this song, like what parts are Dylan, what parts are Sam Shepard? And like, I would love to have been a fly on the wall to like see those two working together. Cause Sam Shepard is such an interesting fucking weirdo too. Like, what's the sexiest song? I'm so glad you answered this, because nobody ever answers this question.
Really?
Yeah, this is nobody does.
I'm surprised. You probably were looking at my list and able to guess what my answer to this question would be. So, because I think it's kind of obvious. So I chose the Velvet Underground, Venus and Furs, from the first Velvet Underground album. And I think, I mean, there's the subject matter, of course,
right.
for the song. which is based on this Austrian book, and the topic is nothing other than sadomasochism and dominance. And I like there's some brutality in the conclusions to the book that about like cis heteronormative relationships, and I guess you mm-hmm. I don't know how normative you can call them if they're so kinky, but I do think they sort of reflect this Lou Reed's sexual proclivities. Not that the song is autobiographical, but you know, there's that line in the Todd Haynes film about Lou Reed, like something like if sex is going to be hot, it has to be degrading. And if it's degrading, then it's hot. But there's the lyrics, which are kind of obvious, but John Cale's electric viola just is perfect in the song. And I think it might ultimately be what makes it for me is like the sexiest song. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the, it's like the sound of forbidden love or lust. Ooh, and I like listening to that song reminds me of reading, I don't know if you know Angela Carter, but she put out this book of reworked fairy tales called The Bloody Chamber. And they're so like richly sensual and erotic, and they deal with this, you know, kind of forbidden and violent ways of, you know, sexuality and things like that. And I think the Velvets do that in that song in a similar way. And I think it just really captures something. And it's reinforced at every level of the song. It's in the lyrics. It's in the melody itself and Lou Reed's playing. And obviously the icing on top is John Cale. And I think it's so reinforced at every level. It's kind of like an Edgar Allan Poe short story. You know, like everything's kind of pointing in the one direction, you know, to reinforce a certain scene. And that is, I do think it's pretty hot. Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, I totally, and the point about the viola is, it brings it all together. But it is funny how it is, like, every layer of it is just, like, it's like, no, this, like, just in case you didn't realize, like, but, yeah, there is something about it. Now, it's funny because somebody recently picked this as the most romantic song, I think.
So, really? Yeah. Okay. So,
romance, sexy, yeah, hey, I don't know, romance can take on a lot of meanings. Okay.
Well, I think it's like so many things. And I think of music criticism this way too, that it really tells you more about the critic than the song. About his people.
Yeah. We were talking in the fellowship thing I mentioned last night about speculative fiction and how like it tells you a lot more about the right, like, the world itself or whatever that you're creating is all whatever, but like it tells you it's very vulnerable and very like revealing of it's like, oh, well, why do you, oh, okay. And so I think that's like with anything, like again, like with this whole thing, the song picks don't necessarily matter. It's the why of the songs. All right. We got two songs or two questions left, the two big ones, as I say. So what's the song that means the most to you?
So I chose for this one just because you mentioned associations with it, maybe an unlikely pick, but I chose Vince Gill's song, Go Rest High on That Mountain. When I was in middle school, I would hang out with my grandmother a lot. You know, she was older, so she was retired, and we would hang out and she would make me lunch and then she liked to go rest. Well, Leah, I'm going to go rest. And so she would go lay in the bed and I would go lie down with her, and resting for her meant watching country music television. So we would put on CMT. You know, it had the videos. It was kind of like the modern country version of MTV. And that song would come on. It's probably like 1992. It has to have been around then. And that's why I was so well versed in country music from that time period, because I just would watch all these videos over the summer. But yeah, one time this video for Vince Gill's song "Go Rest High on That Mountain" came on, and you know, he's got such a beautiful singing voice. I don't have this prejudice against modern country. It is the thing that it is. It never pretended to be anything else.
Right.
But I do think you can learn a lot about it by listening to certain periods of it, what mm-hmm. songwriters were focused on and what was popular in the country music pantheon at the time. But Vince Gill is a wonderful singer, and that song is so beautiful, and it's so sad and so lovely. And one day my grandmother just very solemnly says, "I think I'd like that played at my funeral."
Oh, wow.
And so I remembered that. And so when she died, like, goodness, 20 years later, longer than that, she died in 2012. My mom and my uncle were trying to think, what should we have played at her funeral? You know, we have to have some music because it's the church. And I immediately thought of that song. I said, well, it's got to be this Vince Gill song, because she literally said to me, I want this played at my funeral one day. That's so amazing. I think that's why, like, that song has a particular resonance for me. And I think, like, yeah. I don't know if it means more to me than any other song, but sure. It's certainly one that has meaning that yeah. where others might not in yeah. some way. And now it's just associated with that moment for me.
Well, that's really sweet. His voice is like, think what you want about the song and the type of music, like, you know, people can whatever, but mm-hmm. you can't deny how beautiful his voice is.
Right. I mean, good singing is good singing.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yeah. that crosses genres, I think.
Yeah. All right. Last question. What's your favorite song? At least as of now, maybe it changes, or maybe it's always this. And I could see it being always this because
you know, it's the only one left on the list. So, yeah. And it's amazing. I haven't mentioned this yet, but so I chose my favorite song for now, Leonard Cohen's song, Suzanne. And it's the opening song on his first album. And it was originally a poem. And I think yeah. it works really well in song form, and I love it, and it is my favorite, and he is my favorite songwriter. My husband and I do the Lenny and Dylan, you know, like the contest, and my husband's like, nobody's better than Bob Dylan, I'm sorry. And I'm like, well, better, but I like Leonard Cohen more. I do think, like, he's limited as a songwriter in ways that Dylan isn't. Like, I think his toolkit is smaller, but if I could just say, there's good poetry and there's great poetry. And then there's this sort of transcendent poetry. And I think mm-hmm. like, not to be too categorical about it, but I think like in the first two categories, you've got writers who know the heart and they write mm-hmm. about the heart. And, you know, the great romantic poets, of course, talked about this, Shelley and Coleridge and Wordsworth all had their treatises. Like, this is what poetry is and what poetry does. But then there's, like, also in this poetry, there's glimmers of spirituality, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then at the next level, you've got the poet priest. And I think of, like, this level of poetry as, like, poets as ministers of the heart and the spirit, but also of the mind. And I really think that's where Leonard Cohen fits. And that's where Leonard Cohen fits when he's at his best. And I'm thinking about this sort of great poet priest tradition, like John Donne and George Herbert, these late 16th century, early 17th century poets. But, you know, I also think of like Thomas Merton, mm-hmm. but definitely John Donne, who's also naughty, you know, especially for the time period. But right. Leonard's like this Jewish John Donne and this worldly John Donne who's also read the Marquis de Sade. And I don't know how else to kind of classify him. But so I think that Suzanne is Cohen at his best. And if I could just like do a close reading of it real quick. The song's first verse focuses on the sort of inevitability of attraction, like being attracted to someone. The speaker plans to resist Suzanne, but then it's not in his hands, really. Like, there's this sort of shared wavelength that's like it's almost like a gravitational pull that the speaker feels toward her. But part of this ineluctable attraction is intellectual. Like, mm-hmm. there's the line, you've touched her perfect body with your mind, and then she's touched your perfect body with her mind. And I think a lot, you were talking earlier about word choice and how important mm-hmm. just like one little word is. And I think sometimes about the choice of Cohen's there to go with rather than in. Like how different would it be if it said you've touched her perfect body in your mind? You know, like that's like salacious.
Yeah.
But with it sort of forecloses that interpretation and then opens up others, which I think about being intellectually stimulated by someone and having that be part of this attraction. But also just the imagery is exquisite. The sun pours down like honey. Christ sank beneath your wisdom like a stone. I don't think it has to mean any one particular thing. And like one of his strengths is assembling this jagged imagery into a whole that resonates something indefinable. And I think that's what he's best at.
Yeah.
So he's a poet.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. I can't believe, like, I just think about, like, this was the first song on his first record. Like, how do you, this is when you start here, like, how?
Yeah, where do you go from here?
Yeah. It's like, if I ever did that, I'd be like, okay, I'm done. Like, I'm never going to top this.
Yeah. No, I think about that too. And it's not even like the Beatles, at least A Day in the Life was much later.
Right. Yeah. This is like first thing out of the gate is you give him Suzanne. And then, I mean, you know, and to be fair, he did okay.
Yeah. He lived up to it for sure.
Yeah. Well, that is, that's perfect place to end this. Perfect song to end this with. Thank you again for doing this. This was way too much fun.
No, it was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you're inviting me to be on your show, but also your thoughtful questions. These are good conversation starters in any case.
Awesome. Well, feel free to use them anytime. I don't know. And everybody should listen to the album, Broken Things. Out now.
Once again, a million thanks to Leah Toth, taking time out of a very busy schedule to talk about a bunch of awesome music and just, you know, sit and have a good time. Hey, that's what this is all about. It's just, I totally invented this show so I could just talk to cool people and have fun and get killer music recommendations. So yes, Broken Things, out now on Spinster Records. I can't recommend it enough. As ever, you can listen to all Leah's picks at the link in the show notes. And yeah, thanks for being here. If you like the show, leave a rating or review. God, I feel like I'm like tripping over my words and it's 8 in the morning and I'm caffeinated. It's like I sound like I'm drunk or something. What the hell? Anyway. Leave a rating or review. You can join the Patreon, patreon.com/FoxyDigitalis for as little as $3 a month. And that just goes a long way. And everybody who is a member, I love you to death. You get extra stuff. You get longer episodes. Hey, you support the cause. But anyway, that ain't for you. Take that $3, that $5, however much, put it towards picking up a copy of Broken Things. How about that? But until next time, keep on listening to whatever the hell you want.